And I can see that Steve McCabe is very much, you're thinking of forming a team, maybe you and me and Bernard Hickey next year.
Utter madness.
Utter madness.
I tell you, he says that completing the Arctic enema and the like make you a winner. I am perfectly content to be considered a loser if that's what it takes. Perfectly content.
A loser and proud of it. Bernard Hickey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Sound daunting to you?
The enema, that word is makes me unsettled in my chair.
I can understand that. It is a word with an unsettling flavour to it.
Did you have to introduce flavour into the conversation?
Basically, you did a three-minute interview and the three of us only heard one word from the entire interview.
I'll now change the flavour. Bernard Hickey is in position in Wellington and Steve McCabe in Auckland for the panel after 4 o'clock, and Chris Gilbert here with what the world's talking about. Good afternoon, Christopher.
Hello, Jim. I think I quite like the sound of that tough mutter. I think I could give it a go.
Okay, so Chris is forming a team.
Yeah, it's not really my thing, which I think is what attracts me to it, but that's not the point right now. Right now we're talking about asteroids.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, chances are that an asteroid big enough to take out an entire city that's hitting the Earth are higher than we think they might be. A non-profit group called B612 Foundation is working on an asteroid tracking telescope. And they've released a video saying that the asteroids hitting the Earth are not as rare as we think they are, and it highlights the 26 times an asteroid has exploded in the Earth's atmosphere between 2000 and 2013. And apparently an asteroid big enough to take out a city, which is about 131 feet or 40 metres, hits the Earth once a century based on new data from the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organisation. And their point, this group's point, is that we don't really have any way of knowing when and where one might hit, so we better hop along and build this infrared telescope we want so much, really, so we can track asteroids from millions of miles or years away and see when they're coming for us.
That one, that width that you mentioned, was about the size of the Siberian space rock, I think, the one that flattened mm-hmm. the tundra and the forests, and I think that was a bit smaller even. And I was reading, the big ones like that, and the ones bigger still, we don't know about many of them at all.
No, NASA tracks a lot. This is their point, is that NASA tracks the larger ones, but not the smaller ones, the ones of, you know, as little as 40 metres, which apparently could destroy a city if they came through the atmosphere and they survived that fire and actually hit the Earth.
Yeah. I noticed that they're arguing about these stats, you know, the likelihood of one of these big asteroids taking out a city on geek sites like Slashdot, you know, people comparing their mathematics and talking about how dangerous, what the odds really are. It's a bit hard to sort out in your mind when you read the discussion.
It is.
But they've shortened the odds, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, there's one claim that asteroid striking is a 70% of the time over the ocean, 99% of the time over somewhere that isn't populated, meaning that once every 5,000 years you'll get a nuclear-type blast over a city.
That's one theory, isn't it?
That's one theory. And there's another one, amateur mathematicians who are saying that about 3% of the planet's land area is considered urban, around 1% of the total surface area of the planet, and that means that any given year there's about a 2% chance of an asteroid explosion happening over a major population area.
That doesn't sound so reassuring.
Not to me.
No.
2%, that's better odds than winning lotto. Yeah.
It is. Oh, we're also only looking at probabilities here. It doesn't mean it will happen every 2 years. People get locked into this idea of probability, meaning it has to happen every so often.
Yeah.
It doesn't. I mean, I'm liking these figures. You know, like they said, was it 3% of the world's surface is actually urban?
Mm. Yes.
You know, chances are, if something does get through, and even if it does get through the atmosphere, which is unlikely depending on its makeup, and even if it gets through at such an angle that it's actually going to hit the Earth as opposed to burning up as it comes through, then it's an odds-on bet that it's going to go somewhere completely harmless anyway. I mean, Jim, the one you mentioned in Siberia, in Tunguska, 1907, wasn't it? Or 1902?
Yeah.
Around then?
1908.
Yeah. Word didn't get out about that one for years. We didn't even know it happened. Most of these do tend to happen.
That was before Twitter, however.
This is indeed true, yes. Yes, if it happened today, the asteroid would have its own spoof account.
Mm. Yeah. Do these things have any climatic impacts? I'm not aware of that. If they have any effect on the environment or the ecosystem?
Only very locally. Mm. Think about it. 40-metre wide rock hitting a 12 million metre wide planet.
I know, but a texter says, regarding that Siberian asteroid that Steve's talking about, had it arrived 13 minutes earlier, Paris. That's the difference.
You say like it's a bad thing.
It's all timing.
Thank you.
Sorry. Now, what are these quacking whales?
It's the Southern Ocean. It's the great mystery of a quacking sound which has come from the Southern Ocean. It's been a mystery for 50 years, but now they seem to have cracked it. It's called the bioduck noise, and it occurs in winter and spring, and it's now attributed as the underwater chatter of the minke whale. It's a series of low-pitched pulsing sounds. They first heard it from submarines in the 1960s. And so what scientists did last February is they placed suction cup sensors with microphones to a pair of whales in February last year.
Yes.
They recorded their noises and they matched them with the sounds of this low-pitched quacking, and they matched up.
Okay. I've never heard this quacking coming from the Southern Ocean myself.
I haven't heard it either.
No.
No. But apparently it's incredibly useful to them now because they can track these whales' migrational patterns.
Yeah.
And it could be they don't really know why they're making these noises, but they think it could be the noise that they make when they're close to the surface before they dive down to feed.
Okay, so whales quack. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Chris Gilbert with us. And the pirates have pulled off a big heist.
Yeah, pirates again. Pirates have raided a Singapore-owned tanker in the Malacca Strait near Malaysia. They've stolen 3 million litres of diesel fuel.
Now,
they did this over several hours. The tanker was going from Singapore to Myanmar when it was boarded by apparently up to 10 pirates armed with pistols and machetes. Two other tankers then appeared, and an estimated 3 of the 5 million litres of diesel on board was transferred from the one tanker to the other two over several hours. The thing is that the ship's captain, the ship's chief engineer and a crew member have all disappeared.
So hang on, what's that telling us?
Well, the police in Malaysia have ruled out kidnapping because there's no ransom request yet.
Right.
So they're thinking that there's suspicions that the three of them could be connected to the heist.
This is one of the biggest, busiest sea routes in the world.
It is. It's the quickest way for these tankers to get from Asia to the Middle East.
So a tanker is stopped and two other tankers take all the oil off it and then disappear.
Over several hours.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. It's amazing that can still happen.
Can you imagine the siphon hose?
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
You mean the old trick you used to do with the siphon hose and the sucking on the siphon hose? Probably something bigger than that.
Where was Captain Phillips and the vast resources of the American SEAL squads? They were nowhere on the horizon. Now, Shakespeare.
Yes, I want to get our panellists' opinion on this because there's been research done on what Shakespeare's wordiest plays are and also his wordiest characters, which have the most lines. And according to opensourceshakespeare.org, the wordiest Shakespeare play is Hamlet at 3,557 words.
Yes.
And it's followed by two other tragedies, which are also very wordy. And another famous tragedy, Macbeth, is one of his shortest at just over 17,000 words.
Not that many words in Macbeth. They're memorable words in Macbeth, though.
That's right.
So in terms of the character?
Also Hamlet, 1,506 lines.
I thought you were going to ask the panellists.
Oh, yes. They meant to guess.
Who would you have said? Well, Steve McCabe was just working out the plays with a pen, you
No,
see.
I'm
now disappointed.
No, I cheated. I was listening to the opening of the show as I made my lunch at home this afternoon, and I thought, I'm going to look that one up.
And you looked it up?
I did indeed. And I mean, here's a fascinating one that I bet no one else will get. Which female character has the most lines?
In the entirety of Shakespeare?
In the entirety of Shakespeare, in the corpus.
The entire corpus of Shakespeare. Which female, Bernard Hickey? He said, passing the back.
This comes from ShakespeareOnline.com. I didn't research this myself. It counts.
Just completely guessing. There's an Ophelia, is that right?
I'll go with Portia.
Portia's number 4, Ophelia's not in the top 5. Mm-hmm. Apparently it's Rosalind from As You Like It.
Ah,
685 lines.
I was about to say that.
Well done. So Hamlet talks the most. He's not just dithery, he talks them, or dithery people often do talk a lot, he talks the most.
Yes, and second is Iago, who was also, I remember, being very chatty from Othello at 1,088 lines, who is also my favourite Shakespeare character.
Is it? Why Iago. Would Iago be your favourite Shakespeare character?
Because Iago's amazing, because Iago, the great thing about Iago is that you can never tell when he's telling the truth or when he's telling a lie. And my seventh form opinion on it, like many years ago, was that Iago believes he's telling the truth at any given moment, which makes him so good at lying.
Okay.
Yeah.
Reinterpretations of Shakespeare by Chris Gilbert. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's an interesting rationale. Now, Bernard Hickey, you'll be interested in this because this is a bike lane with a difference, Chris.
Yeah, it's probably one of the world's smallest bike lanes. Cyclists in the Chesterfield town of Chesterfield in the UK have slammed the Derbyshire County Council for painting a tiny, tiny cycle lane. Locals are calling the 13-foot-long or just 4-metre cycle lane an embarrassment.
Actually, you've got to see this lane to believe it. I saw
yes,
a picture of it.
It's tiny. The thing about the photographs is that the photographs show it got two roads, two parallel roads, and a little bit of footpath in between them, and the cycle lane on that little bit of footpath. And so it's on a small stretch of footpath, and the cyclists pretty much cycle onto the path almost as they cycle off it, excuse me, almost as immediately as they get on.
Yes, that's yeah, right. You hop on the cycle lane
and then you hop off again.
Which is, I mean, it's an extreme example, Bernard, but we've got a long way to go with cycle lanes, haven't we?
Yeah, we've, in New Zealand, hardly any at all. And in Wellington, where I cycle around, surprisingly few, despite it being having a green council.
Yeah, and this council is saying it's all out of context because it's part of a much bigger network that you can't see in the photographs, which I don't really think excuses the fact it's a tiny cycle lane.
Right, there'll be lots more little lanes you can hop on and hop off.
Yeah.
Courtesy of this council, thank you. Chris Gilbert with What the World's Talking About. Coming up, the last panel before the long weekend, Steve McCabe is with me in Auckland, Bernard Hickey in Wellington.